This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. This week it's the thwack of willow on leather as we look at cricket, a game both philosophical and occasionally comic.
This is one of the gaffes I didn't know I'd ever done. It was after the test match of the Oval against the West Indies in 1976, I think. And I had a letter from a lady who said, "Mr. Johnson, we do enjoy your commentaries very much, but you must be more careful what you say, because we have a lot of young people listening. Do you realise what happened the other day when we came over the Oval? Michael Helding was bowling to Peter Willey, who said, 'Welcome to the Oval,' well, the bowler's Helding, the batsman's Willey." And I didn't know I'd said it. And that has gone round the world now, but I never did them on purpose, these things.
I just couldn't resist that, the great Brian Johnson. But let's turn to the more philosophical side of the game. Playing cricket, playing anything for that matter, or exercising any skill, cooking, being a pianist, whatever, relies on something more complex than just the application of intellect to bodily activity. And to find out what might be involved, I spoke to John Sutton from the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Sydney.
Look, my main interest, Alan, is in memory, and I'm interested in the different forms of memory. And of course, one of the key ways in which our past influences us is in the things that we can do in our actions and movement and in the kind of flow of skills. So I've been looking around for a while, I suppose, for an example, a case study, if you like, of a complex skill, a bodily skill, which exhibits memory in all of its complexity. And that was where cricket came in.
You actually play cricket yourself, don't you?
You're a remorselessly mediocre club cricketer. I've enjoyed cricket for many years, yeah. But I suppose I know enough about the game from my own level of performance to get a little bit of a sense of what the top players are suffering when they go through bad times and what they're trying to work on. And it's in particular the way that their mental skills, which is a big phrase in the game these days, their mental skills influence their performance.
So I suppose what I want to ask you really is, why is this a philosophical question? Why is it not a question of simple sporting skills? Why is it not a question of neurophysiology? What's the philosophical question here?
Those fields are of course, relevant to a study of batting, which is my interest in particular. But from a philosophical point of view, if you like, I don't believe in the interest of the old mind-body problem, the classic sort of dualist versus materialist problem, which says, is the mind the brain or is it a kind of ghost in the machine? I don't think that's that interesting anymore. We're a bit bored by discussing about whether there's a non-physical part of human existence. What I think the real mind-body problem is how our thoughts and emotions and feelings, and especially in this case, our memories, influence our bodily activities, and how the body in turn, if you like, gets back at us and interferes with our mind and causes us trouble of various kinds. So memory is a test case in this instance because our thoughts and memories about our own past, our own personal past, our lives, and in this case about things that have happened to us at the crease or in practice at cricket, and this applies equally to musical skills or to dancing, about how those memories influence our bodily performance and the way in which we try to run off our skills better. The kind of cliche, I suppose, among expert performance is that you want to leave the mind out of it and let the body take over. So there's a kind of flow state that is valorized, that's treated as the kind of end point of successful performance by batsmen certainly and by many musicians as well. And I think that's a point of great philosophical interest. What is this flow state and to what extent is the mind still involved, or is it genuinely a kind of mindless activity in which the routine grooved bodily performances have taken over? The demands on memory of, for instance, some very highly skilled concert piano performance are one thing in which there's an extremely complex score often that has to be memorized, and there's a balance between allowing the hands to remember for you and still being, I suppose, alive in the mind to inhabit, say, the aesthetics, for instance, of the piece. But one of the cues, actually, for my interest in cricket came from some wonderful work on jazz piano and on improvisational music. There's a magnificent book by a sociologist who's also a jazz pianist called David Sudnow. It's called Ways of the Hand. And it's a kind of agonizing account of his learning of jazz piano improvisation and how difficult it is and how many times the hands just won't go where you can imagine them, where your mind runs ahead of your body. And one of the things that Sudnow says that really I think applies to the sporting case, to many kinds of sports, is that very slowly, as you become more skilled, as you start to be able to engage in action more successfully, sometimes the mind does still need to be involved. And Sudhna uses the example of various phrases which his teacher used to use as he was learning. Simple phrases like jazz hands or go for the jazz. And at the early stages, as he was learning jazz and was struggling, these were incredibly frustrating because he didn't know what they meant. The teacher was using them to condense a whole array of instructions which weren't working for this learner. But once he gets to some higher level of competence, he can use these as what he calls instructional nudges. They're little maxims, little hints or labels, which, if you like, condense a whole lot of very complex kinds of bodily patterns into some mental set and bodily set simultaneously, which helps you. So in the case of batting, which is my interest, I think there are many similar kinds of nudges to get them back in the groove. Because when you're losing form or when you play a bad shot, one of the key difficulties for a sportsman is to think out of what's gone wrong and to get back into your body, if you like. I think that experts have got a way of drawing on their memories in particular and on their emotional life as well to inhabit and to shape and to sculpt their particular performance. So if you think of the kind of demands of playing cricket against their very fast bowler. What's particularly puzzling about this is there isn't time to respond. And so expert batsmen, in a sense, have to allow their body to make a judgment, a very complex judgment, before there's really information there from the perceptual input to allow them to compute that.
But how much do they need to know before they do that? I mean, do they need to know that this man is a fast bowler? Or if you give them a fast bowler and they don't know he's a fast bowler, what can they do?
In cases like that where they haven't seen a particular bowler before, of course, good players will watch very closely and pick up subtle cues which batsmen like me would miss, and so they'll get to a state of readiness earlier than I would. But what I'm interested in, I suppose, is their personal memory. Now, there's some interesting evidence, not so much for cricket, but for other sports, golf in particular. There's a phenomenon called expertise-induced amnesia, which intrigues me. Expertise-induced amnesia is the case in which really top players cannot recall the details of, for instance, their putts or the choices that they made on the golf course in a highly charged, stressful scenario. Now, in cricket, there are many individual differences, and if you just look at the writings and the interviews of top players, for instance, as a source of evidence here, some batsmen take a kind of pride in not remembering too much about the details of their innings. If you like, they're showing us that they're just living in the present and they're only focused on their next performance, not worrying about the details. Other batsmen, of course, are very different and pay great attention to the details and can repeat to you many years later exactly how they played that shot in that highly charged scenario. So one of the things that philosophers, I think, need to care a bit more about in philosophy of mind in general is individual differences in the ways that people's memory and in general their mind and their cognition and their emotion works, about how personality factors, for instance, play a really crucial role in driving the way that our minds and bodies interact.
Let's get back to a very basic philosophical difference. Philosophers for about the last 50 years have distinguished between knowing how and knowing that. I know that 2 + 2 = 4. I know how to play a scale on a musical instrument. This is all about knowing how, isn't it? It's all about non-propositional knowledge. It's knowledge that you can't put into words.
That's exactly right. It's about what's sometimes called tacit knowledge or implicit knowledge, or sometimes in psychology, procedural knowledge or procedural memory. But my particular interest is in the interaction between knowing how and knowing that. And I suppose the philosophical tradition I'm working in is one in, I suppose, philosophy of cognitive science, in which the mind is always seen as embodied and embedded in an environment, embedded in its world. So action isn't just the output of internal thinking. It's not the kind of last stage in a three-stage process between perception, stuff coming in, thinking that goes on in the head, and then acting on the world. Action is itself intelligent, in my view, and perception and action are always tangled together. When we see the world, it's as a set of possibilities for doing things in the world. And so I don't think that knowing how can operate successfully without the involvement of higher level, more explicit, more consciously accessible knowledge. Equally, the flip side to that is that I don't think that knowing that itself is entirely disconnected from action. It's not purely propositional. It's not purely a matter of knowing facts. I think theories and high-level thoughts, and indeed in the personal case, your own memories, your own autobiographical memories, they themselves, in a way, are kinds of skills. They're things that you know how to talk about or how to act on the basis of. Let me give you an example. And one really mysterious thing about expertise in batting that the rest of us find impossible to understand is placement. How the very top batsman managed to place the ball through the tiniest gaps in the field. Somebody else may play the shot equally well, but hit it straight to the fielder over and over again, get no runs, whereas a Ricky Ponting or a Sachin Tendulkar is hitting the boundary each time, getting four. Huge difference. A batsman has to remember where the fieldsmen are. Now, what batsmen say about this is, of course, that they don't consciously register this all the time. But, of course, the way that the batsman's memory is influencing the stroke play must know something very specific. And what's specific is that the cover fielder, for instance, has moved three paces to his right since the last ball. Now, that's not something that can have been learned in that long, slow training that's typical of knowing how, that's typical, for instance, of motor memory or procedural memory. It's responding to a very particular new situation in the world, and so it must come through some more high-level explicit process.
It suggests something much more subtle than the traditional mind-body problem.
It suggests, I suppose, that thought itself, intelligence, if you're happy to use that word, is itself a dynamic process. It's not a set of set or rigid facts that we store up and hold inside us as if we were massive computers. Human intelligence is much more context sensitive than that, and it's much more specific and geared to action. So it's not that we have a kind of ghostly inner realm of thoughts, whether they're physical or non-physical. It's not the soul or the brain that is the sole origin of our intelligence. It's our embodied activity, which it's not just that it represents and shows off and demonstrates or expresses our intelligence, it's that is our intelligence in action. So it's to rethink thought and the mind in general, cognition and emotion and memory altogether, as much more dynamic than maybe they've been seen in mainstream philosophy.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to John Sutton from the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University about the philosophy of cricket. And I wonder if there's a problem here. Philosophy aspires to make general statements about the nature of reality. But if we're talking about skill, are we talking about one set of skills for cricket, another for playing the piano, another for cooking? Can we attain to general truths?
That's a very difficult question. I think that there will be some principles from the kinds of points I've talked about that do transfer, but that you're going to have to look at them case by case. And so you're absolutely right that there are many ways of thinking of philosophy in which that's not a legitimate part of the philosophical enterprise. I don't see any reason why it shouldn't be, why philosophy shouldn't care about the particular as well as the general. I think that the case of cricket batting transfers not even to many sporting cases. It's like certain other embodied activities and skills like music and dance, and less like others. One of the things that we're looking at in some interdisciplinary studies I'm doing with my colleague Doris McElwain at Macquarie University is looking at yoga and instruction in yoga, where the same kinds of issues about nudges and applying intelligence to the reflexes are there in the practice of developing more sensitive awareness of the ways in which the parts of your body interact. Now, I don't think there's any guarantee that you're going to find the same principles, no, across those two contexts, for instance, or when you look at more mundane activities that you've mentioned, like cooking. But I think that some of the same principles are...
Nothing mundane about cooking.
Nothing mundane. Well, mundane only in the sense that we do it, or some of us do it every day.
Yes.
And I suppose I think that cricket's a kind of laboratory case for the study of skill, but that many of our skills are ones that we do engage in every day. And thank goodness that we're not sitting in our armchairs thinking all the time, that we do engage in practical activities with each other and with the world, in cooking, in all kinds of other bodily activities. And some of the same issues about the interaction between the body and motor and procedural skills and memory and consciousness and high-level thinking come up in these cases. You know, there are many cases, driving's another example, as well as cooking, in which you can just sort of do the same thing over and over again, in which your routines, your grooved bodily practice takes over. But of course, you can influence yourself as well, and there are times when you want to work hard at your cooking, or times when the conditions require you to attend in a new way at driving. And so I think that kind of same issue about the mind-body problem cropping up in these specific contexts is going to be seen in those other occasions too.
It's always seemed to me that Western philosophy certainly has neglected precisely the sort of things you're talking about. It has neglected the fact that part of my knowledge is in my hands. It's not just in my head. Eastern philosophy perhaps rather less so. I think Taoism, I think, rather less so.
I think that's right. I'm not an expert in Eastern philosophy, but certainly notions of mindfulness in certain Eastern traditions, I think, are capturing something of the same point that I'm trying to make, where the mindfulness there is a way of inhabiting your body and your bodily activities fully. It's not a way of thinking of the mind as separate, as cut off from the bodily realm, but of living fully in it. Look, in modern Western philosophy, I think that there are traditions which have taken skills more seriously, perhaps in the more technical tradition of phenomenology that arises in particular from the work of the German philosopher Heidegger. And in recent philosophy, I suppose the American Hubert Dreyfus has produced a series of works which treat bodily skills as, in a way, the core of human intelligence. And he sees expertise as the gradual ability to be free of explicit rules and propositions and facts and to inhabit your bodily more fully. But it's curious about those traditions in Western philosophy which are more influenced by continental phenomenology. They've been very hostile to science and very hostile to cognitive science and to the slightly scientized philosophy of mind in the Anglo-American tradition. And I just think that's an unnecessary opposition. So this project on cricket batting is, I suppose, a test case. It's meant to be emblematic of ways in which the cognitive sciences, including sports science, but also including the brain sciences, can work together with phenomenology and in which actually they both need each other to do better work.
Well, it's not clear why they should be hostile to science, given that the practice of science, particularly the practice of experimental physical science, involves physical skills. And if you look at a great scientist like, say, Isaac Newton working with the prism, well, nobody had thought before Newton worked with a prism, nobody had thought of doing it in a darkened room. And, you know, that was a great experimental advance. Similarly, and rather more horribly, William Harvey working on the circulation of the blood, everybody did horrible experiments on sheep, and if you vivisect a sheep, its heart movements increase quite considerably because it's in a state of shock. Harvey worked on fish, whose movements are rather slower, and it's very horrible, but these are people who have, I can only say, a feel for what they're doing, and that is central to their scientific activity.
Very much so, and those are perfect examples because they show that the world of objects and things, it's not just lying there passive waiting for us to kind of pull it apart. It acts back, and it's difficult and awkward and recalcitrant, and it gets in the way. So exactly as you say, science itself is not a matter of sort of disembodied theory, of merely concocting new algorithms in your head and then applying them in a straightforward way to the world. It's a much more tangled process of interaction between mind, practice and world and the scientific objects. And I think it's a peculiar feature maybe of the study of the mind in the 20th century that many of the mainstream traditions got more disconnected from practice and action and skills than did the physical sciences. And so philosophy of mind has tended to be in the mainstream very individualistic and to see the mind really as somehow inside the skull and consciousness is somehow cut off from the social world and the world of objects and in this context the world of action. But I think there's been a really dramatic change in the cognitive sciences over the last 15 or 20 years for a whole lot of reasons. Many internal changes have led to people saying, well, our old paradigms weren't working. We hadn't managed to build successful artificial intelligence on our old model, which said that facts were the core of human intelligence. We need, for instance, to build robots which can act in simple worlds. We need to think of perception as much more closely connected, tangled up with action, and we need to see the mind itself as deeply embodied.
Let's go back in the history of philosophy. We go back to Descartes. René Descartes, the great French philosopher in the 17th century, a man for whom, by the way, I feel I have to go into bat for these days because he's much maligned, but he's sitting in a room and he's thinking, well, what can I be certain of? And the one thing I can be certain of is that I exist, because I'm saying that I exist, and if I didn't exist, I couldn't say that I exist. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore, I am. But that implies that his intelligence is something that can be separated from his body. Now, I think he's possibly been somewhat misunderstood in that, but certainly his views do institute a tradition in Western philosophy of thinking of intellectual activity, of thinking of the mind as something that goes on aside from the body, or potentially could happen aside from the body. And so you want to take us away from this. You want to talk about the way in which intellectual ability is embodied. Precisely. It's in the body.
I'm delighted you've brought up Descartes in this context. I too want to go into bat, which is an appropriate metaphor in this context for Descartes. I mean, in a way, the most important work Descartes wrote for me is not the Meditations, probably the one that many people read at university, or the Discourse on the Method, but his latest work called The Passions of the Soul, which is a work about habit. It's a book about the way in which the things that we do fall into certain kinds of routines and patterns, and that self-understanding, self-knowledge is a matter of coming to understand your own idiosyncratic patterns of activity, to apply intelligence, in my term, to the reflexes. And I think that was where Descartes got to after many years of struggling with the old-style mind-body problem, the one that crops up in the works you were referring to. And he's well aware that it's the union, as he put it, of the mind and the body that is the most difficult, the most interesting, and the most practically important question for us. And so, as you know, Descartes' aim was to apply philosophy to two areas, to morals and to medicine. And in both of those areas, it's the role of habit that is really important. So I definitely wouldn't blame Descartes for the kind of divorce of mind from body that you're speaking of. I think that's a very real influence on Western culture, but it's one that really doesn't come through till much later, I think, and for many more complex sort of historical and sociological reasons. And by the 20th century, it is one, as we've been saying, that did influence many of the sciences, and that for various reasons, the physical and indeed the biological sciences were seen as the ones which dealt with kind of passive matter, whereas the psychological sciences and philosophy of mind, cognitive sciences, were ones that dealt with stuff that's in the head, that's kind of difficult to get at, even if it's actually embodied in the brain. And so to embody the mind, not just in the brain, not just in that grey matter, but in the body, in the pulsing muscles and in the nerves that run right through the body and in the fingers and in the arms and in activity, that's a real challenge. It's to, I think, go back to a more accurate legacy of Descartes to study habit and skill.
So what you're talking about, for those of us who don't play cricket, for me, for example, what you're talking about would apply equally well to things I do, like music and cooking.
It applies to all of the skills which we need some experience to be able to undertake, and in which some of us are better than others, and we do them better one day than on another, depending on our mood and the circumstances and how difficult, for instance, the meal we're trying to cook or the piece we're trying to play is. But what's common to all of these skills is that on the one hand, they're familiar, and the way that we want to do them each time has much in common with the way in which we've done them before. But on the other hand, we want them to be unique each time. It's much less fun and indeed impossible to try to repeat precisely the way that you've sung or played a piece before or exactly reproduce this meal that you've done. You want there to be some variation. That's, as we often say, that's the spice of life. Sport is a case in which this is brought home very glaringly, that no two sporting contexts are the same. A ball that seems to be coming at you exactly the same way is very often going to be slightly different, even if it is the same. The context of the match and the needs of the situation are very different. And I think that's symptomatic of almost all complex human skills. It's one of the things that makes us most intriguingly human, that we don't just repeat mindlessly what we've done before, that our learning allows us to adapt to new situations, and often in very subtle ways that we're not consciously aware of, and to shape our responses to the needs of the situation.
John, you've obviously thought long and deeply about this matter. Does it frustrate you that it doesn't make you a better batsman?
When I started working on this, my teammates in the club team I play for, of course, were deeply sceptical and predicted that my performances at the crease would get much worse as a result of thinking too hard about the game, thus illustrating the kind of cliche about the body should be what takes over. And of course, that's what happened. I went through a string of very poor performances at the time. I'm glad to say that a little bit of improvement has been seen, and we've had a good start to the season this year. But it doesn't have any immediate practical implications. I think it would be lovely one day if philosophers, psychologists, and sports scientists could work together. And I think, you know, the idea of a kind of interdisciplinary approach to these issues is certainly one to be aimed at. But I'm certainly not going in there saying that the philosophy is going to be how we find the next Ricky Ponting.
Okay, so we won't look for Plato or Socrates at the crease anytime soon.
Well, I think the great philosophers would have some very interesting idiosyncratic styles at the crease, but that's perhaps one for fantasy or comedy.
John Sutton, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thanks, Alan.
John Sutton is with the Department of Philosophy at Macquarie University in Sydney.
Argon, Bradman, every Aussie dips his litter to you.
And if you're a cricket fan, not necessarily a philosophical cricket fan, you might like to know that the original Ashes urn and other cricketing memorabilia are now on display at the Museum of Sydney until the 8th of November. After that, they're doing a grand tour of the nation. First Brisbane, then Adelaide, Perth, Melbourne, and finally Tasmania. Details on our website. The show is produced by Polly Rickard, with technical production this week by Janita Palmer. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net, as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.